This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy. This is iFanboy Books Blow, JLA, New World Order, DC Essential Edition.
Satellite in my eyes, like a diamond in the sky. How I wonder. Satellite strong from the moon, and the world your balloon keeping time for the mother station.
Hello, welcome to iFanboy Books Blow, JLA, New World Order, DC Essential Edition. My name is Connor Kilpatrick. I'm here with Josh Flanagan.
Hi.
The Booksplode is our book review show that the patrons unlocked over at patreon.com/ifanboy, our bi-monthly show where we talk about a collected edition or a graphic novel or a trade paperback or however you want to call it, something outside the regular monthly grind. And we've been using it to explore our childhoods.
My son brought some book from home and he was like, yeah, that's a graphic novel. And I was like, who said that word to you? And he was like, it was with the library. I was like, that's comic books. And he's like, I know. I go, I just need you to understand. Those are comics.
Was it a 20-page book?
I don't know what it was, but it was just like somebody had somebody said it's a graphic novel and not comics, and I was like, I will not have this in my house.
I get you. I understand. Good for you.
Yeah.
So, as we mentioned on our Pick of the Week show about this episode, we went back and forth on which one we were going to do next. We had a plan, and then a second book came along. We're like, oh, no, let's do that one. And then this book came along. We're like, oh, no, let's do this one. And then eventually we had to settle on doing JLA. But it was a good choice because it did come up recently on the podcast. Someone wrote a question in an email about it, and we had a long discussion about it. And I realized I hadn't probably read this since they put those hardcovers out, however long ago that was. Mm-hmm. It's been a while.
I think I read it whenever we did the show. We did a video show about it, which means that it was like probably at least a decade ago.
At least a decade ago. So this collection is a new collection from DC. The DC Essential Edition includes JLA 1-9 and JLA Secret Files number 1. All written by Grant Morrison. Majority of the art by Howard Porter. Also, is it Oscar Jimenez?
Jimenez.
Yeah, is the other artist that does a two-issue story here. This is a seminal work for many reasons, both personal and comic-wise. It came out in 1997. Sort of smack dab in the middle of a change in comics. This is a book that we'll discuss in a minute that has its feet both in the early 90s aesthetic of comics and design things, and also sort of it's ushering in the quote-unquote modern age.
Well, this is interesting because it dovetails very much with the Blue Superman book that we talked about not too long ago.
Yes.
And I think where with that one, what we saw is a book that was like old books but starting to be modern. I think this is an old book that is a modern book that, you know, took place earlier, so it's got elements of earlier comics. That sound right?
The writing style could happen now.
Absolutely, and I noticed that as I was reading it.
That's what made this book really stand out at the time, because when you have this book that's coming out, I mean, the first three issues took place before Superman was blue, and so that, you know, that's concurrent with that book we reviewed before. It's a totally different kind of writing style. I remember reading this in 97, we were in college. I remember reading this and having my mind absolutely blown. So the personal touch is that I gave it to my buddies who had been into comics as kids but had fallen out of them. I said, if you want to know what comics are about right now, read this book. And they all read it. And then a few years later, maybe a year later, 2 years later, you were roommates with those same guys. And they gave you that same book and turned you back on to comics through JLA. So this is the book
I've been reading since then.
Brought Josh back into comics and brought us together as comic friends. And it changed everything in terms of... We've discussed this on the Pick of the Week show. It changed how superhero teams were formed going forward. Mm-hmm. Basically, from this point forward, and there were some exceptions, the Justice League has mostly been about the big members of the DCU. When Bendis took over Avengers, he said, I want to make the Avengers more like the Justice League. So that's why you got Spider-Man and you got Wolverine and you got guys like that on the team. Mm-hmm. Gone is the era of Dr. Druid on the Avengers and Firestorm on Justice League. It's all about, you know, it's almost the same lineup now as it was back in 97 in terms of the character archetypes. If you see, as the story opens, the previous Justice League, that's sort of a time-honored tradition happened with Keith Giffen too. The old team is sort of dispatched, and it's got a very, very weird-looking Metamorpho, and it's got an Atom Smasher and Ice Maiden, who wasn't even ice, and they are dispatched quickly, and the Justice League has to form again, and it's all the big guys. Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Flash, Kyle Rayner, Green Lantern is the only sort of new guy on the team, Martian Manhunter, and Aquaman, and that's your big seven.
On that note, before we move on to the team as it exists, I don't know a lot about Metamorpho, but I always think that I really like the character specifically because of this little bit in it.
He's great.
Like, he does. He's really interesting. He does a really super smart and super heroic thing. And he's the one where I'm like, I want to read the book that Grant Morrison would have written about that guy.
Right.
I think that every time I read this, I was like that. And I say that it's important. It's the first thing that happens in this book.
Right.
Like which is really fascinating.
A heroic sacrifice. And, you know, he dies. Yeah. He gets a statue in the statue garden, which is a little detail I love.
That panel of him, like, after he crashes. And I never forget that image either.
Yeah.
Something about that always sticks with me where, he's. And there's a line that says something like, was he dead? And it was like, he's more like inert. And I was like, that's brilliant. Like, it's just.
Yeah.
There is a lightness. This is what I said. It has a foot in the past a little bit. But there's a voice that Grant Morrison has in this that he does not have anymore.
Well, so he was 37 years old when this came out. Not a young pup, but he had done Doom Patrol. He had done those, Invisibles. But he wasn't really a big mainstream guy at this point.
Yeah. And I think, the Invisibles, the Doom Patrol, those kind of things. I think if you were to read those now, you would be like, oh, yeah, that's Grant Morrison. Whereas this, not as clear. He definitely did a voice for this.
And it's a voice that's very recognizable later on as sort of his superhero stuff. Yep. And I'm looking at the sales numbers. And interesting, the sales built on this. Because when this launched, it did respectable numbers, but it grew. It started off around in the 78. If Wikipedia can be believed.
Right.
It launched at 78,000. And then by, 10 issues in, it was doing 111,000.
By the way, I mean, if a book launches at 78,000 now.
Yeah.
Pop the cork.
Right.
And this is also during, the worst time in comics history, if that gives you any idea.
Right.
Economically.
So there's a couple of things happening here. As we talked about, there's 9 issues of the series, which covers, I think, 3 stories.
Yep.
The opening story in which an alien race comes down to Earth and very quickly unseats the Justice League as everyone's favorite superheroes and starts to marginalize the Justice League. And there's a big reveal. And there's a spoiler warning here. If you've never read this book, there's going to be spoilers. They are revealed to be white Martians, and that's one of the great all-time Justice League stories. And then there's immediately we start a membership drive, because I think he had the idea early on that he wanted a 12-person team, which also flies in the face of what we said earlier about him wanting to be the big guys, because he did end up adding Steel, he ended up adding people like that. But it launched as the big guys.
Mm-hmm.
So the membership drive, and they add a – there's a great character piece about the woman of tomorrow,
yeah,
who was a robot.
It was almost like a – that was not a real Grant Morrison-y story. It was very like a classic sort of almost like a 60s sort of like
Silver
a
one
shot of morality. Yeah.
He's always been a very Silver Age-y writer.
You're right. I was as I was saying it, I was like, no, I'm wrong.
Was it one issue with her? I think it was just one issue.
I think.
Where Dr. Ivo and Tio Morrow build an android to infiltrate the Justice League, and they take her on as a team member, and she sort of becomes self-aware and fights against her programming and ends up dying also, and also gets a statue in the statue garden because she had proved herself for the team.
Yeah. I don't think we need to spend a whole lot of time on that. But by far, my favorite part of that is the two mad scientists talking to each other. And then after she turns good, they don't get mad about it. They're like, look what I've done. Like, and they open champagne. It was the best.
It was Dom Perignon.
Do you remember how good he did his mad scientist in 52?
Yes. He's
remember
good.
Remember he
that.
Had whoever it was like on eBay?
I don't remember the details.
Basically there was a bit in that he wrote in 52 that was all the mad scientists. It may have been Ivo and Dr. Morrow and a bunch of those characters. And at one point, like, he had one guy bidding on eBay as their master plan was going. He's like, not now, we're about to win. And he's really good at those characters.
Well, my favorite part of that story is that, so that's the first appearance of Superman Blue, the electric Superman. So he goes to the Batcave, and the entirety of dealing with this is Batman says, interesting outfit, and Clark says, interesting times. And that's it. And they don't deal with it ever again, which was great.
However, there are bits where, like, but then after that, he doesn't act like it's not Blue Superman. There's some.
No. He plays with the powers, but that's the most he explains what's going on is.
Yes, exactly.
Interesting times.
But I did notice there's a bit where basically he reverses something to put poles on the moon.
Yeah.
With his powers. And I was like, that's fucking brilliant. Like, it was brilliant.
Well, this was the deep thinking Grant Morrison into.
Yeah.
He taking that British style of comic writing into the Justice League. And I remember, you know, the next story where he introduces Zareel, the angel character, who he originally was going to be called Hawkman, but they didn't. Hawkman was radioactive at the time, so they didn't call him Hawkman. That's the story where Superman wrestles the evil angel or the demon.
Asmodel.
That's one of the all-time great moments, too. That's one I think about a lot, too. He also moves to the moon. Oh. Like, he really does play with the powers there, and it was... I mean, this is a great run. And then it ends with the multi-part Green Arrow story where they recruit Green Arrow to join the team. It's Connor Hawke, because at this point, Hal was dead, Oliver was dead. A lot of those Silver Age guys were dead, and so it was their legacy characters. And Barry was dead, obviously. They've all been captured by the Key, and they're all living in these fantasy worlds. So he gets to play with telling these Elseworldsian stories for the main characters while Green Arrow, the least powered member, is running around the Watchtower trying to save the day. And I thought that was a really great story, too.
Yeah, that was good. That was really good, actually. Because you get a lot of credits of this. You get a lot of people talking about Batman alone in the third issue, you know, and how he's the one who sort of undoes everything. But they gave Green Arrow, and I say Green Arrow, and I want to be like, it's not actually even Green Arrow. It's Connor Hawke. You know, they give him his it was a really good moment. And I thought that was also excellent. I think the Angel story. Zariel.
Zariel.
I think that was my favorite story out of this.
It's interesting because as a kid, I wasn't into it.
Mm-hmm.
The character I'm not into, but I liked the story a lot. I just don't care about him as a character. So when he goes away, it just finds me.
Yeah, no, I thought it was ballsy to be like, no, we're going to do. And this is, it's not so far. When was Preacher going on at this point?
97, had to be, yeah.
A lot of this kind of stuff was in Preacher, too, where the angels weren't angelic necessarily. Right. There was a lot of other stuff going on. There was, you know, scandal to it, which is very real. And also Hellblazer. A lot of that. So that sort of fit in with the stuff at the time.
Yep.
But I thought it was ballsy to, you know, put him, you know, not on the Justice League, but more or less. I thought there's a really interesting bit where it stood out to me that Flash is talking to Superman and Superman like has this moment of doubt where he's just like, I don't know, everybody expects a lot from me. And I was like, that's weird that he would say that. And then later, like, he just sort of effortlessly, not really effortlessly, but personality wise, just he does the thing. He doesn't give himself credit for it, but he stands up to this character, you know, who Asmodel, who's more powerful than anybody can imagine, you know.
Yeah.
And it was a really big moment.
So let's talk about the team, the dynamics. So you've got mulleted Superman in the beginning, which is unfortunate because Howard Porter's art doesn't shy away from it.
I mean, one of the other bits I want to get this is we're going to talk about Grant Morrison. I want to get to Howard Porter, but I just one of the things I really liked, and we'll touch on this as we go through it, but I want to make sure that I get it. He gets so much better. He's not bad at the beginning, but by the end, I was like, he's killing it.
Yeah,
I really thought that. Anyway, go ahead.
So Superman is obviously the main guy, but he's not the main character. I really like the Flash Kyle dynamics.
Wally.
So Wally is ostensibly the youngest person, but then Kyle comes along because Hal's dead. So now Wally has someone to look down on, and that's all we really want.
Now,
in
you
life
famously is... don't like Kyle.
No, I don't like Kyle.
What were your thoughts on him in this?
I wasn't happy at the time.
I'm saying now, though.
Oh, now as an adult. you know, he works as that character who is like, oh shit, I'm in a room with Superman and Wonder Woman. You know, he's a Kitty Pryde. You need that character. Yeah.
You know what I love about him, that I always have loved about him, is that he had more fun with his constructs.
Yeah, well, he's an artist, so yes.
Yeah, I know, but I love that aspect. I remember reading I think it was a Chuck Dixon, like a little prestige book, and like he had to go across the cosmos, and like he created a monster truck for himself to drive in through space, mm-hmm. and I laughed, and I just thought he would do stuff like that, and Hal never did, and I always thought that was a fun. His mask is dumb, basically.
The mask is terrible, but they're a really fun duo, and it's fun to have someone totally overwhelmed by the experience. Martian Manhunter is a big character in this. He's the classic, you know, emotional pillar. He's the one you'll find unrecognizable now in comics.
This is my. When I think of Martian Manhunter, this is who it is.
Yeah.
Like, this is the one that set the tone for me on that character.
Aquaman is reluctantly on the team, and he's the angry, you know, post-hand getting cut off, long-haired, bearded, weird chest plate Aquaman.
But he's kind of surly and realistic in a way.
Yeah.
Like, there's times where he's, like, he's angsty and pissy, but then he's like, no, that is kind of cool. Like, he's got a lot of that going on, which I like.
Wonder Woman... she's not in it a ton. I mean, she's there, but she's, you know, she's not one of the main characters.
A little formless.
And Batman, obviously. This is, you know, Grant Morrison would go on to do years of Batman. So this is his early take on Batman. I want to mention, so 97, this was 2 years after they gave him the all-black suit when he returned after he lost the mantle to Jean-Paul Valley. He came back with an all-black suit that looked a lot like the one from the movies. And just in case you wondered if that's a new phenomenon or not, I thought he had that suit in this book, and I had somehow memories of that. So when I was reading this trade, he's in the classic, you know, sort of darker but blue and gray suit. I thought they recolored it. So I put the call out to.
Oh, I saw that. I meant to ask you what that
our
was.
Our patrons, and they confirmed with the original issues that this was not recolored. So I wanted to thank Edward and Keith, who are patrons, who helped me make sure I wasn't losing my mind. He is wearing the classic suit here.
Now, what you should know is that I could have answered that question because. At that first San Diego Comic-Con that I went to, I bought the number one issue, which I had not owned, and I have it here available.
I think I may have given those away.
I paid $17 for it, and it seemed like the most money in the world. And by the way, I have not recouped my money.
You didn't recoup it?
This will surely be worth the investment.
I think the story everyone remembers is the first story, the Martian story. That's the one that kicks it off. This band of white Martians who all have powers or sort of similar to... they all have John Jones's powers, which are all similar to Superman. Right. So there's a guy who looks like the Flash because he runs really fast, and there's a Superman-like character. They all sort of mimic the Justice League, and they end up totally marginalizing the team and subduing all of them, except for Batman, who they sort of dismiss as no threat because he's just a human.
Did you notice that it was interesting that, like, this is basically a populist authoritarian storyline? And I was like, well, this is appropriate. I do have a question about Batman for you.
Yeah.
In the context of this. I assume it isn't, but this doesn't... Is this one of the first modern instances of, like, Batman is the best and can do everything? Or did that exist prior?
It's pretty early, especially in this context of being like, oh, he's always got a plan and he's not...
Right.
You can't take him out.
Yeah, because I don't know that I've read a lot of Justice League before this, and I wasn't sure. I was like, was that always his personality, or is that something that, you know, that this helped originate?
This is definitely a level up in that scenario.
Interesting.
And this particular story where he's the one that figures out they're Martians, he's the one that uses the fire against them and saves the day, is definitely something kind of new.
Oh, I like that even more then.
Let's talk about Howard Porter.
Okay.
I love the way he draws... Batman is sort of demonic, and he has sharp fingers, and he has this weird body language to him. So Howard Porter, this wasn't his first work. He did The Ray. That was his first work 3 years prior. It was a short-run series with Christopher Priest. And then he did the 95 summer event, because that was when the events happened in the summertime, called Underworld Unleashed that Mark Waid wrote. There's some elements of that. Neron is in this. He's the demon that brings in the Zuriel story. He was the bad guy in that story. And then he was brought on to do JLA 97, which was his, like, a big major book he did. And he did that for, I think he did 3 years on it. It was a pretty long run. But he's still very green. You can see it. He's raw. And I know...
Yes.
Modernize might not like it, but I really liked to see how raw he was and how you could still see the talent there and how he improved. But also, like, it's almost like watching an Italian film from the 60s. Like, everyone's really emotional in their body language and in their facial expressions. Mm-hmm. And I really liked the heightened aesthetic of it was something I really enjoyed.
Yeah. And I think it did take me a little time to adjust, because there's stuff about it that I can understand the idea that if you have a modern sensibility with comic books and you look at it, your first instinct is of, oh, this is earlier and rougher. And you could see, like, some of the stuff about Batman's costume that is a little different. You can see everything is super grim. But as you get past that first issue, which is really good, I think, for the time, really dynamic, very mm-hmm. exciting. As you get into the second and the third stories, the layouts take, like, a step up. Like, all of a sudden, he hit his stride, and he was, like, comfortable. And he's like, I know exactly what this needs. And I think that he doesn't get enough credit for giving this the energy that he did. The layouts are extremely dynamic. You'll have these pages with like a big thing will be happening, then there's panels overlaying. The panels are three-dimensional, and then there's a ton of perspective even in one sort of long narrow panel. Yeah. You know, on that page where there's two or three things happening. He's working with a lot here. There's characters all over the place, always in action on every page, and the inks are flying off the page. He's breaking panel borders. Like, he's really pushing it.
He has his, I don't call them tricks, but things I really like. He really likes the character coming right at you in the panel.
Yeah.
Almost reaching off the page. He really likes the character flying right at you. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at a Flash page, page 59, your digital reader, where he's running right at you. He really likes to put the action right in your face.
Yeah.
I really like that a lot.
Some of that's kind of classic Kirby. And in that one that you're talking about, like, he's out of the panel. His knee, foot, and hands are coming out of which is that, you know, sort of 3D effect.
Yeah.
You know, but even that, like, he's – that page actually only has five panels on it. But look how much is going on.
Yes.
The blurs in the background. He didn't just draw blurs. There are people back there who are fuzzy. There are, you know, the lightning is crackling all over Wally. And then the one after that's a really quiet panel, you know, where there's a castle in the background. You just see the lines going across the water. I mean – everything is like that. It's hyperkinetic.
Yep.
And there's pages like that all through this. God, I love pages where I don't think it fits in modern comics anymore, but there was a thing for a while where they would integrate the sound effects into the panel shape.
Mm.
Like, at one point he hits, like, sonic boom speed. And so Barry hits, or no, Zoom, Z umlaut U M, hits the ground. There are four vertical panels going down. The panel he hits,
yes.
It says, Wump. I was like, that's awesome. Or Wham? I can't even tell.
W-
doesn't matter.
H-U... I don't know. He made a very loud sound.
It's Wood. It's W-H-U-D-D-D.
Wood. Wood. That makes sense.
Which is perfect.
Yeah.
Like, as I kept going, I kept noticing more and more of those panels, and I was like, nobody draws like this anymore.
You're right. I think it's everyone's constantly moving.
Yeah, it's, you know what it reminds me of is, it's a little Matteo Scolari in that sort of energy, in that everything is amped up a little bit. That page with the Flower of Wrath.
Oh, yes.
You know, it's all canted, and, like, people are standing on all different levels, and, like, it's got, you know, all the little pointy things coming out of it. Like, everything is like that.
Well, it's a Silver Age book that's done in a more modern style. Right? That's kind of what Grant Morrison's whole superhero aesthetic is. And with Howard Porter, he found someone who really could bring that energy, to crank the energy up. And whether or not you like the way he renders things, it's undeniable the amount of energy on every page. And there's no wasted pages. There's no cheated pages. There's no, you know.
No.
I'm not someone who necessarily complains about lack of backgrounds, but there's a lot going on in all these pages.
Like I said, we had that person who wrote in. It's probably why we did this, like, you know, subconsciously. It's like, I didn't like the art in this book. And I'm reading it now, and I was like, I don't understand how you could say that. I did, like, right at the beginning, but as I kept going through it, I was like, this is going to sound snobby, but, like, if you're putting context and storytelling and all those things in there, and you think, well, what's Grant Morrison? Well, Grant Morrison's a guy who loves and values the Silver Age, but he's not from that time, so he does it on its own. And you're like, wow, the editor nailed it.
Yeah.
By putting Howard Porter on this. Nailed it. In exactly the reason you just said.
I also couldn't understand it. Like, he's green. You know, the faces are not necessarily always match up. And mm-hmm. some things you're like, oh, he should have fix the perspective on that. But it's almost like that's beside the point. It's like seeing a band who doesn't necessarily completely polished, but has all the energy and passion in the way they're playing. And that's kind of like what all the energy and passion is in the art. It just may not be the most polished art in the world.
Perfect metaphor. It's definitely the case because it's just like it's tons of energy and it's tons of movement. It's exactly the tone that it needs to be. And whether it's sort of not letter perfect and how those faces and hands and all that stuff works, it doesn't matter, which is, you know, which is a lot why a lot of people would say they like Rob Liefeld.
Right. Which is fine. But, I mean, that thing is artist
everybody
personal.
Draw your own line.
Everyone has their what they like. Now, I was reading this and wondering, why is this working? But did we discuss it in the last Booksploded when we talked about Avengers? But why is this working, but modern team books seem to fall kind of flat?
I got a little bit of sense that a lot of modern team books are trying to do this.
Hmm.
As opposed to coming up with the next thing that is right for now. I mean, we have so much stuff that reaches back to what came before and trying to recapture, which I guess this one was doing too, to a certain extent, but it had been long enough. I don't know. I don't know if the bag of tricks has been used up and putting the team together has just been done so many times that it doesn't feel like it's fresh. You know?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have an answer for it, but you know, when this book was coming out, when Bendis was doing New Avengers, those books felt vital and important. And like, if you were following those worlds and universes, you had to be reading those books. And I don't know that, as much as I'm enjoying Avengers, which I really am, I don't know that it feels vital. Like, you have to be reading the Avengers book.
Well, I mean, you can absolutely see, I think you can see the influence that this has on Jason Aaron's Avengers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's very, I don't know, was it three issues for the first arc? You know, it's a big team. They're all kind of doing it because they have to, you know, like somebody has to do it. We're not necessarily here, but for it, but this is what it has to be. And we'll try it again. And, you know, it was, you know, a big, huge world beating thing. I don't know. I do think that there's things that, I mean, we talked about like this exists in two times. There's things in this that Grant Morrison can get away with that you could not get away with now, primarily because comic books were still kind of for kids at this point, and now they're just not.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's all of these sort of expectations and masters that you have to satisfy now that I don't think Grant Morrison had to worry about. Also, I don't think Grant Morrison ever has to worry about it because he's Grant Morrison, but, you know, like he could say it was for kids and make it impressive on his own and sort of do both things, whereas now, you know, everybody reading comic books are 40-year-old dudes.
It's just interesting. I mean, I would never say, if you weren't reading Avengers, you're not missing anything. If you're not reading Justice League, you're not really missing anything. But if you weren't reading this at the time, you were missing something. And that's just, well, it's just interesting to see that.
Extrapolate that out, then. What comic do you need to be reading now, or you're missing something?
To feel like you are reading the heart of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this was the heart. The heart of the universe. I don't know what the. I think everything is so siloed now, and everything is so, yeah. Everyone's in their own world. Every book's always been somewhat siloed, but it just, everything is written for its own trade, and it's siloed, and it doesn't feel like there's a connective tissue to the universe. When Bendis was doing it in the early 2000s with New Avengers.
And that has its benefits too. Like, everybody gets to get what they want. I would say largely that, I mean, I've come around on this. We talked about this in the show a lot, but like, a lot of comic books aren't fun anymore. And I'm tired of it. Like, now I get a book that's fun. There's just like this, all these book flows, these last chunk of them that we've done, like, our big thing is like, boy, that was fun.
Yeah.
And it just highlights how not fun so many comics are.
They're dour.
Today. Well, because they're, yeah.
Speaking of fun, I want to talk, I loved this all the way through. And also, we didn't mention the last issue, The Secret Files, was like their secret origin, which was they had a mission together before the mission in the first issue. And they fought Starro, which is a callback to the original Justice League. And that was fun, too. My favorite issue, I think, of all these issues, which was really great, was the Woman of Tomorrow story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because I really, really loved the membership drive. And it was a chance to see a bunch of characters come through. You know, they're doing it's basically like a comedy bit in the middle where they interview a bunch of people on Max Mercury and Damage and
Tommy Monahan.
Tommy Monahan, my favorite bit was the Hitman bit where, you know, we mentioned we did a whole bunch of book explodes on Hitman, and He was a Garth Ennis character who hated superheroes, and this is totally like a little funny joke at poking at their expense. And I laughed out loud when he was leaving and Aztec was coming in. He said, "Don't mention money. They don't like it." I just laughed. I laughed out loud on my couch. It just got me.
I like the line. Two panels before that, I've got X-ray vision and telepathy, and I kill super people for money. And I'm just like, it's so good. And then he existed there. It still makes no sense that was in the mainstream DC proper.
Right.
It's crazy.
And then, you know, that's where they get Green Arrow from, and that's where other people come from. But that was just I thought this was a really great, I mean, they had a couple more pages than they do now, but I mean, this story didn't feel like it was a quick, this felt very meaty, had a lot going on. You had a whole arc with this character. It took a lot of time. It was also really emotionally impactful at the end when she sacrifices.
Yeah. There's also he's getting away with putting a lot of dialogue on a page.
Yeah.
If I went by my rules of comics today and I looked at a lot of these pages, there's too many words on that page. Does not feel like it when you read it. And I'm giving it the benefit of the doubt a little because it's from an earlier time, but mostly it wasn't painful. The dialogue is great. Really good dialogue.
That's why I always say it's all about the quality of the words.
Yes.
It's not about the number of words. It's the quality of words. And
yeah, absolutely.
He has the best words.
But I'm going to move right on. What was great about that, I think my favorite thing is that basically they met her, and after a very small amount of things, Superman's like, "Yeah, you're in, whatever." And that was such a silver, you know, Bronze Age kind of thing.
Yeah. But also kind of like a Superman kind of thing, right? Like, he's just like,
"Yeah,
hey, you want to join the team? You're cool." And she does.
I love it.
The implications of it, you can't think too hard because they can see through her eyes and she's hanging out with them. So, and they call each other by their real names when they're hanging out. So you have to not worry about that and just sort of take the story for the meaning it's using and enjoy Ivo, enjoy Tio Morrow arguing and bickering about studying mad science at Harvard. And it was just so good.
I think that was my favorite part of the whole thing, actually. the reversal of them, instead of being mad about what happened, they were so pleased.
They were proud of themselves. Look at page 115. Look at that bottom half panel with the car on fire that's freaking out John, and the angle is so extreme from below, and it's just, and Superman's really close.
That's what I'm talking
about. It's a great panel. And yeah, above that, the flight path, Superman's cutting, so it's creating a panel border, and Wally's sort of floating above that. It's just, the pages are really interesting.
They're really thoughtful. Like, you don't get this kind of page just by, all right, here, I'm going to put six panels on here and make some, you know, and thumbnailing. Like, the page is conceived of as a whole.
Yeah.
And it's not just, he is telling the story, which is the most important preeminent thing, but he's also like, how can I make this the most exciting dynamic thing possible to match with the story and the dialogue that is in this script? And I don't know how this was produced.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was full script or whatever, but it's aspirational.
Swipe to the next page in the top panel of Wally running off the building and up the side. That's another great panel.
Oh my God.
It's a great panel.
His perspective is off the charts.
Yeah.
Ugh. The next page, again, you know, like you're basically looking down.
Yeah, over Kyle's shoulder.
Yeah, every one of them. That's what I start. This is when I started noticing, like, look what he's doing. Like, I don't see comics that look like this anymore. I see comics that are technically worlds above this and maybe even stylistically super impressive. But, like, what do you want from a Justice League comic? This is, I can't imagine anything better.
I'm not going to compare him to Kirby because he's not.
No, but
when people who are younger or are not as versed in comics look at Kirby and say, I don't get it. It's the same kind of thing. It's the energy and the action and the perspective and the dynamism. And Porter's got it in spades.
Yeah.
He doesn't have the level of draftsmanship that Kirby had or other artists have, but he has star power. You know, it's like a movie star. Why is Tom Cruise a movie star? It's an unknowable thing. You know, it's not his acting ability. It's this unknowable ingredient that Porter has in his art that makes him, at the time, a superstar artist.
I see a lot of Kirby in this. I mean, those, you know, Kirby by way of Neil Adams, which leads to this.
Yeah.
It's that breaking the panel border. It's that hand reaching out towards you. It's that, you know, dynamic, that urgency. Like, that all comes from Kirby. And Kirby's draftsmanship, one thing or another, it was much more staid because it was new then. So they were able to stand on top of that and take it further. And there definitely is stuff from the 90s that tried to do that too that was not good.
Mm-hmm.
But it works here.
Yeah. It's a really good collection.
It
I'm
is.
Really glad it was meaty. I mean, it would have been fine if it was just the first one, but I really like that we got to go all the way through the Zareal story, through the Woman of Tomorrow story, through the Green Arrow story. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important to end on that Green Arrow story because
I loved that.
It was sort of a capper on that first sort of segment, because after this we start adding members of the team.
And the next story is Apocalypse, I think.
Rock of Ages was one of my favorites, yeah. And that was an amazing, amazing story.
That this
was a really special time for. Let's talk about Oscar Jimenez just a little bit, because he does do a couple of issues here with the Green Arrow story. I really liked his art at the time, and I don't think I remembered how weird it is. Like it has a much more
feels like art you could see now.
It does, but also it's a little strange. Like look at that first page of Tomar Rey giving the ring to Superman. Like,
yeah,
he's a little weird. There's a lot of lines in weird places, and it's hard to put your finger on why, but it's a little strange, and I like it.
As we get from there into the next couple of pages, though, the sort of human stuff, it looks more modern to me.
Yeah, oh, for sure it's more modern.
It's definitely, you know, you would see something that looks like this now a lot more often than you would see something that looks like Howard Porter, and I think that the coloring of the time here belies that.
Mm-hmm.
But as you get to like the Superman, Superman looks like a like a real person.
Yeah.
Where he doesn't. Howard Porter's don't look like real people.
Yes, I remember as a kid, and this is almost like Carlos Pacheco like, but a little bit stranger. As a kid, I was like, "Whoa, this is." I mean, I liked it a lot. It's just it's really interesting. This story is so good though, with Connor having to use his dad's trick arrows from the trophy room, and he didn't use those kind of arrows, so it was all that was a great.
I love that
arc for that.
That was good. Also, you got to give Jimenez credit for the decrepit old Joker.
Yeah.
Great drawing.
Creepy.
Yep.
Really creepy. I love that he got to play with, you know, these Elseworlds stories. So Wonder Woman's sort of like Indiana Jones-esque story, and Flash is this strange sort of almost Kingdom Come-inspired story where he looks like Jay a little bit covered in the Speed Force, and, you know, Batman's apocalyptic story where the Joker's, you know, going to kill his family, and that was creepy. And Superman is—he's also Green Lantern for some reason. But I just—it was just a lot of imagination in those stories.
I got to give Morrison credit for this sort of really wacky key character. Like he's sort of self-referential a lot, and he doesn't quite come off as being like mustache twirling dastardly. He thinks he's a genius, but there's also like an element of that's a problem.
there's a great flashback at one point to the original appearance back in the 60s, and here he's sort of like that character who has been turned up to 11, but is self-aware enough to realize he's being kind of ridiculous. And this is a really great issue. This run is a really good run.
We're back to the first page of the Secret Files.
Okay.
Which would be like 225.
Yes.
There's a cop who's behind. That's Stan Lee, right?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
That's weird.
That's strange.
That's definitely Stan Lee.
Yeah. Well, interesting thing about Porter is, so for this particular collection, he drew a new cover.
Mm.
It recalls the original covers. So you can swipe back and forth if you're on your iPad. You can swipe.
Oh, wow.
And it's interesting to see, because Howard Porter still works fairly regularly. We talk about his works, you know, every now and then on the show. In my head, his art hadn't changed that much, but if you swipe back and forth, it has changed a hell of a lot.
Yeah.
And he has actually a lot of Oscar Jimenez in him now, and the characters look a bit more human. There's a bit more weight to their faces and their bodies, as opposed to being very lithe and sharp before. So it really is an interesting way to see how much he has grown in the last 30 years as an artist.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
He is one of those guys where I kind of like, this was the first comic book that I read, basically, from the modern era. And I was always like, well, where'd that guy been? So, like, he would do a thing every once in a while, and I would, oh, Howard Porter, and I'd get excited just because this made me so happy. He did a Shazam, Captain Marvel thing with Judd Winnick a miniseries at one point that was real good, too. He's great. He's like a DC artist to me. Like, he's great.
What's funny is in the new cover, he can tell he's only begrudgingly drawing the mullet on Superman. It's very much hidden behind his head. If you didn't look closely, you wouldn't even see the sort of wisps of curls behind his neck, but
little flip.
God, that was a mistake on every level.
Well, it was at the time.
I get it.
The mullet was a mistake in general. It just shouldn't have been, but it was, and it got everywhere, and what can you do about it? What's interesting to me is that now we see him a lot of time on Flash, and to me, he's taken on a lot of Scott Collins kind of stuff, which is I think, unexpected. And I can see that on this new cover.
But didn't he hurt his hand really badly? Like, I think that's what happened was he...
Possible.
He had really badly injured his drawing hand at one point.
And, I remember hearing that.
And had to sort of heal from that and sort of... I don't know if he... So, yeah, so... In 2006, when he was doing Trials of Shazam with Judd Winnick, he couldn't finish because he hurt his hand, severed a nerve, almost the entire tendon in his thumb, and it took him years to recover. And so
his
art's a little different. But you see him now regularly. Justice League 3000, good. Superman Beyond, Superman work he's done. Like I said, I read this probably 10 years ago the last time.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it back then, but I was a little worried that I would read this and go, oh, no, it isn't good. But I was
not
wrong.
The case.
It was very good.
Yeah, it was really fun to read. And even though, like I said, even though the pages looked really dense, you know, it read really fast.
It did read really
fast. In a good way.
I was really impressed because I thought, oh, shit, this is longer than I thought. I'm in trouble. But then I flew through it.
Yep.
Just like the pages and the art, the story moves really fast as well.
It's really enjoyable. Like, it is a comic from 22 years ago. And, you know, I mean, I think we could use more comics that are like this now.
For sure. For sure.
Definitely.
So this is JLA, New World Order, DC Essential Edition, story by Grant Morrison, art by Howard Porter, Oscar Jimenez, and then there's John Dell, Ken Branch, Chip Wallace, Hannibal Rodriguez were inkers, Pat Garahay, and John Calise is a colorist. A lot of these guys you see, there's their names you still see every week. Ken Lopez was the editor, the litter in all these books, and really fun. If you've never read these comics, just check it out. I mean, it's worth it.
You know, if you don't end up with this version, basically it's...
There's a lot of versions.
Nine.
Yeah, there's a lot of versions. Out there.
There was short trades. They were three issues a piece, or
That's
six,
true.
Maybe less than that. They were really short. I think the first trade was just the first three issues, and then the second one was sort of the second half of this book. So it would have gone, you know, 4 through 9.
And there's the hardcovers that collected more. They put out like four hardcovers that did the whole Morrison run. Like we said, if you've never read a comic from this era, the art might be a little challenging at first, but stick with it. Really sort of look at what's going on the page. It's really worth checking out. Lots of fun. Great versions of these characters. They're very classic, very iconic. I had such fun reading this book. I'm glad we found another fun book to read. So now the pressure's on for 2 months from now.
I think next time we're going to definitely not do a comic from the 90s that we loved. We're going to have to switch it up.
Never say never,
Josh. Come back. All right. I'm having a lot of fun doing it.
All right, so this is JLA.
Whatever it takes.
If you have thoughts, go to iFanboy. They'll be posted for the show. You can tell us. And then, so this show is unlocked by the patrons. It switches off with the Talksplode, which is Josh's interview show. So next month, there'll be a Talksplode. And we'll be back with another Booksplode in 2 months. When we know what it is, we'll let you know. And until then, I'm Connor.
I'm Josh. Thanks so much. Satellite in my eyes, like a diamond in the sky. Satellites strung from the moon and the world you're burning deep in time for the manifestation. Winter's cool, spring races, and I can't understand. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.